slept upon Croat, and I've camped by the Wayne stones as well. I've sunbathed on Kinder, been burned to a cinder, and many more things I can tell. My rucksack is off in my pillow, the heather is off in my bed, and sooner than part from the mountains, I think I would rather be dead. Oh, I'm a rambler from Manchester way. I get all my pleasure the hard moorland way, and I might be a wage slave on Monday, ah, but I am a free man on Sunday.
And good morning. My name is Andrew Geller, and I am here with Tom Lutz, author of the newly released Doing Nothing, A History of Loafers, Loungers, Slackers, and Bums in America. Tom is speaking tonight at the Powell's Books on Hawthorne, which is between Southeast 37th and 38th on the north side of the street. Welcome to KBOO Studios.
Thanks, very glad to be here.
So, Doing Nothing, this is a long book about nothing, actually, which is sort of its own irony right off.
Yeah, the reviewers love to make fun of how long the bibliography is.
Yeah, well, that's all the fun I'm going to make of it.
Okay. So
it's not, you know, I don't want to criticize the title, but it's not really about doing nothing. It's about doing things that sort of aren't the kind of culturally expected ways of spending your time.
Yeah, what I really wanted to talk about were anti-work ethic subcultures, and so it's principled stances against the work ethic. You know, just people that are doing nothing for a moment or for a day or for a week. I'm not particularly interested in vacations or, you know, stealing a little time at work, although that comes into play. but mostly about people who have, you know, there's a long history of manifestos against work of you know, Karl Marx's son-in-law's famous "The Right to Be Lazy," mm-hmm. a great pamphlet from the 19th century. There's a whole Bertrand Russell's "In Praise of Idleness," William James's "The Gospel of Relaxation." A lot of people, you know, philosophers, literary people, sociologists, lots of people who have argued against a blind adhesion to some work ethic, which is clearly a result of an industrial regime.
I love that idea. I'm going to read more. I've read some a little bit about anti-work ethic. I've done radio about time stress and how to relieve that and overwork and scheduling. And I sense that, you know, I'm sure there's tremendous differences within cultures or between cultures on kind of what's an appropriate way to be anti-work.
There are cultural differences. There are historical differences. I trace this, the figure of the slacker. I use the slacker, even though it's a slightly ahistorical term. It really only comes into play in the 80s and 90s.
It's only somewhat geographically, I perceive.
Yeah. It's an American term primarily. You know, in Japan there are fritters. Frei Arbeiter, it's actually a German borrowed term for kids who are, or people who are against work and don't want to work. Mm-hmm. So every place has its own flavor, has its own, you know, you can see the marks of the time and the culture on this figure. But in other ways, it's very similar. Samuel Johnson's Idler in the 18th century, the American Lounger, Joseph Denny in the turn of the 18th and 19th centuries. Whitman calls himself a loafer. Right? Thoreau calls himself a saunterer. Right? At each point, the name and the flavor is a little bit different, sometimes more or less depressive, sometimes more or less joyful, sometimes more or less angry. There's a lot of similarity between these characters at the same time.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the differences in the terms that you're using, because you mentioned beforehand that you know, a loafer isn't a slacker, isn't a lounger, isn't a rambler.
Right. Why don't we
just start off with a loafer, because that's the first term in your subtitle.
Yeah, The loafer is a mid-19th century variant. It's what, as I said, it's what Whitman calls himself. He says, I invite my soul to loaf. I am a loafer. Whitman, interestingly, of course, is famous for these long poems in which he describes every kind of work in his culture, right? The barrel maker and the wagon wright and the wheelwright and the carpenter and the bricklayer and the hod carrier, and he always just kind of sings these songs about workers, and at the same time he's a guy who loves to loaf and thinks of himself as a loafer and promotes loafing. Before the loafer is the lounger, historically. And the lounger comes in right very, very early on. I guess to back up a second, I want to say that this is an Industrial Revolution phenomenon. Before the Industrial Revolution, everybody agreed that work sucked. You didn't want to do it. If you were unlucky, you had to work. If you were lucky, you didn't have to work. You know, lucky birth, lucky accident of, you know, your life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only with the Industrial Revolution that people started to be encouraged to internalize a work ethic, and at the same time, the slacker ethic, the loafer lounger ethic arises in, along with this push towards work ethic.
Well, now, are you drawing a distinction there between, we all, even if you don't have paid work outside the home, we all have to work to maintain ourselves, to survive. So are you drawing a distinction between those two?
Yeah, in the same way, as you said, you'd looked into kind of time stress and time discipline. Uh-huh. Our relation to time, our relation to the clock, and working in relation to the clock, and these kinds of things is an effect of the Industrial Revolution. If you're a slave, you're working when you're told to work. You're not working in relation to a clock. If you're an agricultural worker, as the vast majority of human beings were through the vast majority of human time, you are working in relation to agriculture. When you bring it in the hay, you're bringing in the hay, and you work until it's done, so that it doesn't get rained on.
Right.
And
sun up to sundown.
Exactly.
If it's light, you're out doing stuff.
You're planting before it rains. You're working in relation to nature, not in relation to a clock, not in relation to a production schedule. And it's that attempt to get people to work in relation to a clock, which was a long, painful process for the industrialists.
And it seems so, I don't know if natural is the right word, but it's just, it's kind of like that fish doesn't know it's in the water kind of thing. It's like you just work by a clock schedule. It's just sort of assumed that's how things are.
Yeah, yeah. We're trained in it. I mean, one of the reasons you go to school for 12 years, getting yourself ready to be a worker for the rest of your life, is that you're getting trained in scheduling working, working in relation to a clock.
At a old anarchist info shop here in town that some people in the building will recall, 223, and maybe some listeners down on just across the bridge on Burnside, we used to have a poster that featured clocks prominently, and I believe someone's face or something, and it said, "If you liked school, you'll love work."
Yeah, I mean, most educators will admit that this is one of the main functions, simply of scheduling classes by the hour, rather than based on some kind of other pedagogical principle.
So let's go back to some more of these terms. You referenced slacker a little bit. We'll maybe come back around to that. Let's hit the last one in the subtitle and then some others that are mentioned in the book. Bum has a modernly, nowadays rather pejorative term, but I assume it wasn't always so.
All of these terms could be used pejoratively, and most of them were used pejoratively. To call somebody a lounger was, or a loafer, when Whitman claims it, it's a lot like when people claim queer. Right, it's take a pejorative term, claim it as your own identity, as a way to kind of transvalue and transfigure that insult, turn that insult into a point of pride. Right, and Richard Linklater says that's why he called his film Slacker, for instance, in order to do the same, make that same kind of move on the word, and bums in the 1930s, 20s and 30s. Right, there's your friend's song that we opened the hour with.
Mm-hmm. Manchester Rambler by Casey Neal, for folks who don't know.
Uh-huh. I mean, that's in a long tradition of of songs like it. I mean, it sounded very much like the 20s, 30s, the IWW songbook kinds of songs, which among which were Hallelujah, I'm a Bum.
Yep.
Right? And Big Rock, Candy Mountain, and these kinds of songs that are about being hobos and being right. And that, and to be a bum, of course, is an insult. When Humphrey Bogart in a film calls somebody a bum, it's an insult.
Right, you dirty bum.
Exactly. Yeah. But to claim it as an identity is a way to say, no, I am against, the conventions through which being a bum is a terrible thing to be.
I suppose another term that I didn't quite necessarily associate. Well, I mean, I guess it does make sense. Is the term hippie, which was originally coined by the media to describe a subculture they didn't quite really understand, kind of merged out of the beatnik culture, which I imagine somewhat merged out of the bum culture of the generation prior. And again, you know, hippie was reclaimed by a lot of those folks and turned around to be a positive descriptor.
A lot of us folks, I guess you would have to say. I
personally don't like the term hippie. I like freak.
Yeah.
Which most people, again, associate as a negative term. But in fact, if you look at the way in which it's used within the subculture of, you know, it's like a close relative of the hippie, kind of.
Subcultures often have fun with the kind of labeling that that comes from outside that subculture, right? To be in a subcultural relation is to be resistant to these these cultural definitions. That's the whole kind of, in a way, that's a central form that the identity takes, is that resistant identity. And so to play with the labelings of the larger culture is among other things, it's just fun.
Mm-hmm. Going through all these terms here and referencing, you know, hippie to beatnik to bum. Mm-hmm. Do you ever think of doing like a family tree or like an ideology of, you know, which helped spawn the next?
Well, in a sense that the book does that for this one issue,
like a physical image,
right? It's hard to say because there are lots of different strands in any one of these cultures, right? I mean, obviously the beat means, you know, according to Ginsberg and Kerouac and et cetera, that it means both beat up, right? Kind of beaten down, downtrodden, and, you know, beatific and, right? This kind of spiritual part of the beat ethos. Both of those ideas are part of what, part of the beat relation to things like work. I'm just tracing that part of this family tree's lineage. Mm-hmm. It's like a strand of the DNA rather than the whole thing.
Right. Now, let's look at a couple terms that are not used in the U.S. And I think my notes aren't as organized as they could be here, but I think it's flâneur from France. And were these the folks who... and again, you know, it's not so much that people aren't necessarily performing useful functions in society. It's just the way in which they do it doesn't adhere to the kind of culturally expected norm and scheduling, etc. And if I recall, these folks took just great pleasure in sort of walking around and observing and. Well, I'll have you talk, and there's another point I want to make up that is going to be really interesting.
All right. The flâneur is a version very, very closely related to the Anglo-American saunterer. Right? Okay. A flâneur is somebody who walks around, doesn't just stand around and watch the world go by. Right. So there are like cafe society bohemians who have a kind of sitting ethos. The flâneur has a walking ethos, but a very, very, like the saunterer, slow walk. You know, Thoreau says there are very few people who can saunter correctly. It's not an easy thing. You know, in the same way that Oscar Wilde says doing nothing is the hardest thing in the world, the hardest and the most artistic. The flâneurs believe that, you know, you needed to walk really, really slowly because the urban world, it's an urban thing of the flâneur. The urban world is moving so fast, and the modern urban world is moving so fast. There's so much coming past you that to walk quickly is to miss the world that you live in. You have to walk slowly. So the image is of taking your turtle for a walk. You know, which I love that image of having a turtle on a leash, you know.
Yeah, I had to read that a couple times to make sure that's actually what the word said when I saw that. And I thought, wow, first off, how do you leash a turtle? I mean, maybe, you know, maybe you don't. It's just kind of, you let the turtle roam.
Yes, right.
Was that a reasonably common thing to see in, I would imagine, Paris?
I think it's mostly a joke.
Okay, you know, so people didn't really walk turtles. It's more a metaphor for how you're supposed to move.
My guess is that somebody walked a turtle at some point. Somebody was walking along with a turtle. Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
There was more talk about it than there was turtles.
Right.
And a lot of this stuff, you know, a lot of what I came to understand is that a lot of this stuff is talk. Right. I mean, there are of course people who are flaneurs, but we know about the flaneurs who wrote about their flaneurisme, you know, the people who wrote about, you know, when Thoreau writes about sauntering, that's why we know about sauntering. The slacker is a literary figure for a long period, and then, the loafer, the lounger, the bum, this whole array. They're literary figures, then they become, film figures. They're fictional.
Mm-hmm.
Any of us can have a relation to this image, and we can say, yes, that is who I am. Or we can say, no, that's exactly who I'm not. But it's a fictional figure.
You're listening to Tom Lutz. He's the author of Doing Nothing, A History of Loafers, Loungers, Slackers, and Bums in America. It's published last month from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And he is in the studio here at KBOO because he's reading at Powell's Books tonight at 7:30 p.m. This is the Hawthorne Store, between 37th and 38th on Southeast Hawthorne at 7:30. You can hear what else he has to say. I imagine you'll be doing some reading there, signing books, and you can pick up copies there, I'm sure.
I was thinking about just doing nothing there, but I think that probably is just not funny enough.
People would expect a little more than that from you. I mean, you only have a five appearance book tour. It's not like you're going to wear yourself out.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so you referenced urban versus rural phenomena related to doing nothing. Is this really primarily an urban phenomena? I mean, Thoreau and Whitman, I mean, historically, there wasn't as much urbanization and the phenomena still existed, but it really seemed, as you referenced, the Industrial Revolution is where a lot of this came forth.
Yeah, and the Industrial Revolution is what makes for the modern urban scene, and mm-hmm. and it's clearly out of that mix, out of that cauldron that the slacker and the loafer and the lounger arise. But often precisely because of that, the idea was for some people to leave behind the urban mess, the urban industrial mess, and find someplace out in the country to, you know, that was my experience. I did the back to the land movement, and
but now you live in Los Angeles.
Now I live in Los Angeles. not exactly the same thing anymore. No, And I understand that, you know, the image of Los Angeles that exists in Portland, it's I want to say it's not that bad, but it's certainly not the kind of idyllic farm that I lived on in the 70s.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so I probably should get around to the whole thing of, well, why is it you wrote this book? And I guess I'll ask one of the other joke questions. How long did it take you to write the book?
Oh, yeah. Well, I did. There was a period. I love doing research. I love, you know, wandering around libraries. I can go to the Library of Congress and read, you know, 20, 30 books a day for weeks on end. I just love it. Partly I love it because I don't have to write. The whole time I'm researching, I don't have to write. And writing is the hard part of writing. So there was a period where I think, you know, my agent, my editor, my wife, they thought I was in a persistent vegetative state or something. I just was producing no pages for the longest time. It took me, you know, it started when my 18-year-old son moved into onto my couch, and he is now 24. So
is he still on the couch?
No, he's in the kind of Hollywood world. So he works, I think it's very much like the medieval peasant. He's like bouts of intense activity, like haying or planting. And then, right, he's on a movie and he works 16 hours a day for 6 days a week. And then, then he stops. And then he's a screenwriter, in between. So he's, that's a slacker lifestyle, being a screenwriter or any kind of writer.
Right, right. Okay, so just back to the urban rural. You know, at least nowadays, I don't imagine that, just given the way the economic system is globalized, and, you know, we hear of, you know, there's 2 billion people who live on less than $2 a day, et cetera, and other such statistics. And my perception is that those people are probably working a lot to be able to survive. So is there a rural, quote-unquote, do-nothing ethic around?
The thing I'm talking about in this book is really a middle-class phenomenon, right? And so it's when you have a bourgeoisie which has those moments in their lives where they think about what they're going to do with their lives. And so it's that moment of choice. Like, what am I going to do next? So my son on the couch at 18, he's graduated from high school. He's trying to figure out what the heck he's going to do. And that is, you know, one of the available identities at that moment is to be a slacker, to be a loafer. And without that choice, the thing just doesn't arise, right? The issue doesn't arise. The ethos doesn't arise. So for people who are, you know, trying to pick a life out of the dumps of Manila, or for people who are, you know, in the gold mines, in the diamond mines,
or even just subsistence farming,
right? Although there's less of that kind of independent subsistence farming than ever. People who have no choice, this whole issue is not their issue. It's people who have a choice, and that's why for a long period this history is a history of men. In the industrial culture, because women had fewer choices, and it's only when that choice becomes possible that you start to get female slackers and loungers and loafers.
Well, I mean, on that point, I'm curious if maybe a smaller percentage of women who find themselves with a choice now after not having one historically, you know, basically life centered around dealing with the house and the kids, and I, you know, feeding the husband, et cetera, et cetera. Given the choice of maybe getting an education or just being able to work outside the home for money, is there so much of an interest among women who now have a choice in choosing to have a slacker sort of lifestyle, or is it more that women are going, right, you know, it's not that I don't want to work as such, it's just I want to be able to try and do something else.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting the way in which as soon as, you know, the whole Rosie the Riveter story, right? Women enter the workforce in the U.S. in a major way during World War II. And it's in the 50s that that women are dealing with this issue of choice in a fundamental way, more widely than they ever had before. And you start to get Diane de Prima and Joyce Johnson, women who are associated with, you know, are friends with and know the whole Beat movement. And they are starting to kind of promote a bit of a slacker ethos themselves. And very shortly thereafter, you get Betty Friedan and the Feminine Mystique and this kind of critique of women who are not, the critique of lack of opportunity for women. Mm-hmm. So to be a progressive woman, to be a feminist, means to be pro-work. The slacker option is in a way only voiced by very conservative right-wing women in this period who are saying, why would you want to go out and be a doctor or a lawyer when you could just stay home and play with your kids? And that's a very, you know, considered by the very people who would be creating a slacker ethos for women at this period is considered very retrograde.
Right. But it seems that, so maybe there weren't much in the way of beatnik women, but when the hippie era came along, there was certainly a pretty substantial share of women who just joined that subculture as well, up to and including, you know, some of the famous musical performers and other artists mm-hmm. in the era.
Absolutely, and Alicia Bay Laurel, for instance, who writes "Living on the Earth," the bestseller in early 70s. Right, that women start becoming guides to this kind of life. I mean, there were a few people like Helen and Scott Nearing wrote their books together, Back to the Land books together, mm-hmm. Starting in the 30s. There was always a sprinkling of women, but not very widespread. And then yes, after the 60s, there starts to be a kind of equal opportunity slacker life going on. And you know, it's kind of bastard child is Anna Nicole Smith.
Right. Okay. Well, I have really enjoyed talking to you about this. And
thanks, Andrew. Me too.
Tom Lutz is the author of Doing Nothing, A History of Loafers, Loungers, Slackers, and Bums in America. He's written several other books as well. And this very evening, he is talking at Powell's Books on Southeast Hawthorne Street, which is located between 37th and 38th down on Hawthorne. That's a 7:30 engagement and speaking, questions, signing, the whole bit, huh?
The whole thing, yeah. All of it. Working hard.
Cool. And and so you're between, this is your Northwest segment.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Coming from San Francisco and going on to Seattle.
And you'll be up to Seattle. Yeah. And lots of great press. I encourage folks to check a copy of this out. And for the Thursday morning radio zine, I'm Andrew Geller. Stay tuned for Art Focus with Julie Bernard.
My apologies to Modu. I could not find any Glenn Washington. I don't know if I'm looking in the right place. Good morning, everybody. This is a Thursday morning radio zine. Coming up next, Art Focused. Host Julie Bernard interviews Sam Gould and a couple of friends, I see, of the Red 76 Collective. They do event-based projects that are rooted in art theory. This sounds kind of interesting. I think I'm going to listen. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, hear reports on the arrests of lawmakers in the Gaza Strip, the ACLU's suit against the government to release records of surveillance, and a look at a new report on electronic voting. All that coming up next on the Thursday morning radio zine. Stay tuned for Art Focus.